today on Against the Grain. At a time when the far right has become more visible and emboldened on the streets, what lessons can be drawn from the past for building a mass left politics against the right? I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with radical writer Gabriel Kuhn about struggles against the far right in Europe, historically and today, and the role that sports has played in working class politics. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Austria between the wars was a cauldron of radical politics and reaction. The Austro-Marxists, in power after the end of World War I, launched an audacious experiment in collective city life known as Red Vienna, which the great economic historian Karl Polanyi called one of the most spectacular triumphs of Western history. Among other things, they saw sports as a key component of radical culture and a new society. As the threat of fascism grew, they also established working-class militias connected to their sports associations to defend against the right. Austrian writer and translator Gabriel Kuhn has written extensively about radical politics in Europe, including struggles against the far right, past and present. He's a former professional soccer player and the editor of Anti-Fascism, Sports Sobriety, Forging a Militant Working-Class Culture, published by PM Press, which documents the history of radical working-class organization in Austria in these years. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I'm connected to PM Press. Gabriel Kuhn joins me from Sweden. Gabriel, at the end of World War I, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was defeated in the war, broke apart. Can you remind listeners about that history which set the stage for the rise of the left and the reaction against it?
Right. So the Austro-Hungarian Empire during World War II still consisted of territories that include modern-day Austria, modern-day Hungary, but also the modern-day Czech Republic, modern-day Slovakia, Slovenia, Croatia, parts of northern Italy, and others. With the nationalist tendencies in Europe already in the 19th century, and there was a lot of conflict in the empire already prior to World War I, obviously different national identities, different languages, so it had become a very fragile empire. And basically, with the war being lost and the empire being in turmoil, most of those nationalist forces used the opportunity to declare independence. It was only in the interest of the winners of World War I that the empire would be divided. And so suddenly, in the German-speaking part of the empire, which had always been the center and the most powerful, but it was suddenly all by itself and had lost what sometimes referred to as the internal colonies of the empire, that were the basis of the riches in the German-speaking part. So suddenly you had this comparatively small country, and the political party that was able to use that to its advantage in Austria, in particular, particularly in the capital, Vienna, were the Social Democrats. And that led to a period that reached roughly from 1918-19 to 1933-1934, where the Social Democrats introduced many reforms in Vienna, and Vienna was nicknamed the Red Vienna during that period.
And the Social Democrats have a politics that we wouldn't recognize today as emblematic of social democracy. Can you tell us about the Social Democrats, who are also known as the Austro-Marxists?
Yes, so that is absolutely correct. the policies of the Social Democrats in Austria at the time are very different from the policies of pretty much all nominally social democratic parties today. Not only was the Marxist influence on social democracy in Europe in general still stronger in the 1920s and 30s, but the Austrian Social Democrats played a very peculiar role, because because of what you mentioned, the Austro-Marxist tendency, which dominated the party at the time, and which sought to bridge the increasing gap between the reformist socialist approach represented by the social democratic parties in Europe in the 1920s and 30s and the communist approach with you know, the Bolshevik Soviet Union at its center. And the Austro-Marxists even tried to establish an international that would bridge that gap, which was called the International Working Union of Socialist Parties, so basically bringing the Second International of Social Democratic Parties and the Third International of Communist Parties together. That attempt failed, but it exemplifies this sort of peculiar current that in socialism that the Austro-Marxists represented. And so, yes, they were, by today's standards, very radical social democrats.
Well, after the Vienna municipal elections in 1919, there was launched one of the most interesting experiments with building a utopian socialist society during that era outside of the Soviet Union, known as Red Vienna. Tell us about Red Vienna and what it looked like in terms of broad reforms and experiments in communal living in that period of time.
So the center of Red Vienna really was the social housing program. So within a very short time, there were huge complexes built for workers with modern facilities. People from all over Europe traveled to Vienna to study those. I now live in Sweden, and it's interesting if you look at the archives of the Social Democrats here, of the workers' movement, which arguably then grew into one of the strongest in Europe in the 20th century. There are lots of reports of people traveling to Vienna in the 1920s to study this huge experiment in modern social housing. You had complexes of hundreds of apartments with very telling names, like the Karl Marx Hof, which then became a major site of the so-called Austrian Civil War in 1934. So those places had apartments, they had laundromats, nurseries, clinics, were connected with modern forms of public transport. So a lot was done within a very short time to improve the living conditions of poor and working people. So that was one aspect. And then another aspect was that there was a really strong wave of cultural reforms that were meant to benefit working class people. This reached from adult education centers to so-called proletarian theaters, proletarian sports clubs, workers' chess organizations. So all areas of life were pretty much covered, and it was all understood as a cultural as well as social and political rebellion against what was at the time called bourgeois culture.
That's the voice of Gabriel Kuhn. He is editor and translator of Anti-Fascism, Sports Sobriety, Forging a Militant Working Class Culture. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So one aspect of the centrality of culture within the Social Democratic Party, within Red Vienna, was actually oriented around sports. And I'd like you to talk about that, but could you first give us some context for those of us who might not know about the history of workers' sports? Give us some context about the workers' sports movement in Europe preceding that time, and then how the Austro-Marxists saw the importance of sports.
So the first workers' sports organizations in Europe were actually founded in the German-speaking countries at the end of the 19th century. So this was already part of a proletarian cultural struggle where the sports clubs and associations that existed at the time were seen as part of bourgeois hegemony. Even if working class people would join those clubs, it was seen that they would be introduced to bourgeois values such as competition and national chauvinism. And at the same time, the physical activity and the education, also the social learning involved in sports, was seen as important by the workers' movement. And so in order to focus on the positive aspects of sports while doing away with the negative aspects, and at the same time forming organizations that would be able to combat bourgeois culture, one founded workers' sports clubs, and then they grew in several European countries, and national associations were founded. And after World War One, the so-called Socialist Workers' Sports International was founded. And with the German-speaking countries being pioneers in the workers' sports movement in general, it was also not necessarily surprising that in 1926, an Austrian social democrat, namely Julius Deutsch, became the president of the organization. And the most impressive events that the Workers' Sports International organized were the so-called Workers' Olympics. The first one was in 1925 in Frankfurt, and the second one was in 1931 in Vienna. And it was by far the biggest. There were thousands of workers, athletes from all across Europe and even beyond, who gathered in Vienna. And it was all tied, as I said before, into the cultural aspect of proletarian culture in the workers' movement. But also at the time, especially in 1931, with the fascist threat already looming, it was also very much tied into proletarian anti-fascist self-defense.
Well, I definitely want to ask you more about that, but let me just ask you about how the workers' sports movement saw its way of organizing sports as different, because you write that it was based on a rejection of individualism, of competition, and commercialism, which for many people, it's sort of hard to imagine sports without those things. So what did it look like in practice?
Yeah, so for example, to start on the symbolic level, so at the Workers' Sports Olympics, there were no national flags being used. There were no national anthems being used. People would represent their associations rather than a particular country. There was a strong focus on camaraderie, respect, fair play, rather than on the competition and winning aspect. So it was really more of a sort of social event rather than something that would divide winners from losers. Related to that was also that the sports events during the Olympics were accompanied by cultural events such as the theater, literature readings, dance, gathering of different sorts. So it was a focus on the communal experience of sports as joy and play and exercise rather than rivalry.
How did these worker sports organizations deal with gender? Were they mainly male organizations?
They were male dominated, as I'm afraid to say, most of the proletarian organizations at the time. At the same time, I would say that given the historical context, if you look at the archives and the texts and the organizations, it was the workers' sports movement was fairly progressive in terms of gender. So there were not only special organizations also run by women for women athletes, but there were some interesting aspects that were brought up in the context of workers' sports. For example, questioning ideals, female body norms at the time. So the idea that any female that would be muscular was unnatural, an idea that was still very strong. especially in the conservative rural parts of Austria at the time, that was very much challenged by the workers' sports movement. There were, if you look at the workers' sports journals from the time, there were long articles about questions like these. Plus, of course, women were a part of the events such as the workers' sports Olympics. So there is an interesting aspect to it, but it would definitely be false to say that there was full equality in any sense.
Well, we've been talking about the left and the radical left in Austria and beyond following World War I. But of course, following World War I, you also saw the rise of the right in countries like Austria, particularly countries that had been defeated in World War I, also the sites of revolution, but also the sites of reaction. And you've been describing the experiments of Red Vienna. How did the forces of the right, who were they to start with, and how did they see these experiments taking place? How did they reconcile themselves or not with them?
The reaction was very hostile. So the far right basically consisted. If we take the example of Austria, but it was similar in Germany or even in Italy. It consisted of the big landlords in the countryside, plus a lot of the peasantry that was loyal to the those who were politically powerful in the Austrian provinces, which was mainly the Catholic Church next to the landlords and certain industrialists. Then, of course, you had reactionary forces, the old aristocracy that lost its privileges that it had had during the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And you had a certain section that wasn't necessarily wanting to go back to the monarchy, but that really embraced national chauvinism, the kind of pan-Germanic ideas on the one hand, very much certain ideas of nationalism focused more on the Austrian identity. On the other hand, where Italy, Mussolini became a sort of strong figurehead in that movement. And so it was a broad sort of coalition of conservative to far-right forces. And to all of them, Red Vienna and the Social Democrats were seen as clear enemies. I mean, there was no social compromise in Austria at the time. It was politically a very divided country. People were very, in the provinces, where the influence of the Social Democrats wasn't at all as strong as it was in Vienna. I should say that maybe the Social Democrats were very strong in Vienna, where they had about 70% of the popular vote, and in some of the industrial centers in the south and the north of Austria, but the rest of the country was very much very conservative. And so it was a very divided country, which to a certain degree it remains to this day, as a side note. And very early on in the 1920s, the right-wing forces started to form militias, the so-called Heimwehren, home defense units, and threatened the social democratic achievements even by force, which then led to a reaction of the Social Democrats. They founded their own militias, the Republikanischer Schutzbund, and eventually all of this led to the so-called Austrian Civil War in 1934, which unfortunately the reactionary forces won.
So the worker militias that you just mentioned that were formed in the early 20s in response to the militias of the right, what did they look like? What was their connection to the sports organizations?
Right. In the beginning, the militias were founded, as in various other European countries, especially also in Germany, basically as self-defense protection units. So the threat from the far right was strong enough that there were security concerns whenever a social democratic meeting were held or whenever a social democratic demonstration was held. And so in the beginning, the militias were really there to protect those events. However, the conflict and the crisis became so strong so quickly that the entire Austrian Republic, the new Austrian Republic after the end of the empire, seemed threatened. That's also why the workers' militias were called the Republikanische Schutzbund, so basically the League for the Protection of the Republic. And at this point, it became a more militarized organization that grew up at its high point in the late 1920s. It had 80,000 members that had access to arms, were well organized in various units, both in Vienna and in some of the industrial centers around the country. And the connection to the workers' sports movement was very strong. So the workers' sports clubs were the main sites of recruitment for members of the militias, and there were very clear overlaps, even in the so-called Wehrsport, which kind of translates as paramilitary sports, literally maybe defense sports, but more like paramilitary sports. So at those meetings, you would have people would do cross-country running, or they do shooting sports, or they throw hand grenades, things that were seen as athletic on the one hand, but very clearly tied to military action. So the connection between those two movements was very strong, which is also personified, in a sense, by Julius Deutsch, who I already mentioned as the president of the Socialist Workers Sports International. He was also the chairman of the Austrian Workers Militias.
So as the threat of the right grew through the 1920s into the 1930s, and of course the rise of the right preceded that of the Nazis in Germany, who later invaded Austria, but how did the leadership of the Social Democratic Party think about how to fight fascism, and did they deploy these workers' militias appropriately in that effort?
Right. So we already talked about the fairly radical character of the Austrian Social Democrats in the beginning. So a key aspect of this is that in their 1926 program, they still had a paragraph that said that they would pursue parliamentary means as long as that was possible in order to build socialism. But at the point where the counter-revolution, the reactionary bourgeois forces would be so strong that this was impossible, they would deploy other means and try to establish a dictatorship of the proletariat. And the workers' militias, in theory, should serve that purpose. In hindsight, one has to say that they were deployed too late in order to prevent the fascist takeover of Austria. They were employed in 1934. In February 1934, which led to the Austrian Civil War that I've already mentioned. At that point, the reactionary forces were already so strong, plus there were some organizational, maybe tactical problems during the Civil War that led to the defeat of the workers' militias. There were certain events, especially two, one in 1927, one in 1933, which I can say more about if you're interested, where historians sort of agree that had the Schutzbund been employed at those events, that would have been a fairly high possibility of having the upper hand, and possibly it had been possible to prevent what then became known as Austrofascism. Otto Bauer, the main theorist of Austro-Marxism and the party leader, agreed with that later on during World War II, that the party leadership was too hesitant in deploying the Schutzbund.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Gabriel Kuhn. He is editor and translator of Anti-Fascism, Sports Sobriety, Forging a Militant Working Class Culture, which talks about the workers' militias and their connection to sports in the period preceding the fascist takeover in Austria in the 1920s and 30s. Gabriel Kuhn is also a former professional soccer player, author of All Power to the Councils and Sober Living for the Revolution. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Gabriel, you were just talking about how there was a reticence on the part of the Austrian Social Democratic Workers' Party to take power in the late 20s and then in the early 30s and to deploy the workers' militias against the fascists because there was a fear that if they did, it would spark a civil war. But ultimately, a civil war came anyway. And at that point, the population was what? Apathetic, no longer supportive of the workers' militias and the Social Democratic Party? What had shifted?
I think that was part of it. There was a lot of criticism by military experts. I'm not one of them. But there was a lot of criticism after the Civil War that said that the timing of the deployment was wrong, and there were organizational problems. Some of the workers didn't get, because most of their arms at that point, the workers militias were already outlawed, so their weapons were hidden, and some of the workers didn't get to the weapons fast enough, and so there were those kind of problems. Also at that point, the Austro-fascists had already been in power, or let's say the people who would then, after they won the civil war, establish the Austro-fascist regime, had already been in power for a year, so they were in control of both the army and the right-wing militias, which wouldn't have been the case, for example, in the late 1920s. And it is true that at that point also, because so much conflict and crisis in Austria had preceded the outbreak of the civil war in 1934, that many in the population, there was maybe what you said, a certain apathy, and maybe the mass uprising and the mass backing of the workers' militia struggle that the Social Democrats would have hoped for didn't materialize in the way that they had wished. So there were different factors that played into the defeat in 1934, which had disastrous consequences for the country.
And yet, as you also point out, in Austria, unlike Germany or unlike Italy, the working class took a stand to stop fascism. They were ultimately defeated, but they actually did still attempt to do that. Do you think that was owing to the history of the workers' militias and Austro-Marxism, that happened in Austria and the equivalent didn't happen in Italy and Germany?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that the average Austrian worker was a more dedicated anti-fascist at the time than the average German or Italian worker. That certainly had to do with the level of organization in the working class, politically as well as militarily. So yes, absolutely.
I'd like to turn now to the present, connecting the threads of opposition to fascism, earlier era, and opposition to the far right on the streets today. Obviously, there's no comparison between Austria in the 1920s and 30s and Europe or the U.S. today. While you have organizations of the far right, including some that are in the streets, we're obviously not seeing ascendant fascism. That being said, what do you think is the appeal of the right for working class people in Europe today?
I think the main reason, and this is going to sound like a fairly simple explanation, and of course it is more complicated, but essentially the reason is that we live in a time of crisis and the left has very little to offer to people who suffer from the crisis. And so the right has established itself as the apparently most serious challenge to the neoliberal order, to globalization, which to a lot of people has become a bad word, and people are buying into very simple and very false explanations for the crisis and possible solutions. So immigrants are blamed, social minorities are blamed, and the unfortunate thing is, as I said, that the left has very little to offer on the other hand. And so you have various social groups. It's not only the working class, but there is, it's true that a lot of working class people vote for right-wing parties and organize in right-wing organizations. And this is arguably the biggest challenge for the left in Europe at this point, how to respond to this.
When you say that the left has nothing to offer, what in fact is the left offering, just for people who may not know from over here?
Right. So I think at this point you have very marginalized radical left-wing groups in Europe that hold on to what I think are right ideas about a socialist future, but their influence is negligible for all sorts of different reasons. There is a lack of organizational strength. There is a lack of influence in public discourse. And there's also a problem of self-marginalization in both academic circles, subcultures, fraction parties. So this is one part. And the other part, which you could still consider part of the left, at least the liberal left, really has, especially now that the threat of the right has become stronger, it has a very strong tendency to embrace basically the neoliberal status quo as the last line of defense against the right. So to exemplify this, I think in the 1990s, most leftists, and not only radical ones, but most leftists would have seen the European Union as something negative, an organization, a political economic organization that was established to rival the U.S. In the international, in the global struggle for imperialist control, an organization that has established a very brutal border regime that serves the interests of big business more than of average people, and so on. Today, most leftists will defend the European Union because it seems that at least it's something better than a return to the national chauvinism that right-wing parties offer. Now, the question is that if that really is the last line of defense, then yes, you can understand that in an historical emergency situation, you would take those sides. But if by doing that you lose all historical promises of the left, and you're basically abolishing the left as it is. And so I think this is happening on the one hand, and on the other hand, the organizations or the people who hold on to the historical left-wing promises are very marginalized, and somehow this has to be changed.
You've written about the retreat of class politics on the European left. What do you think motivated that retreat?
I think there are several factors. I mean, one is that the makeup of the left in Europe radically changed in the 1960s and 70s, partly, I think, as a consequence of the strong student movement in the 1960s, new social movements that emerged. The working class or working class folks and also the traditional working class organizations kind of started to play a weaker and weaker role, and a lot of people that took over leading positions within the left came out of middle class environments and universities. So this is one aspect. Another aspect, of course, is that class composition in European countries changed dramatically post-World War II. Related to that also, class identity. The strong workers' movements of the 1920s and 1930s and their organizations were gone. So class composition changed drastically. The composition of the left itself changed drastically. And somehow class really disappeared from the radar of most leftist activists and groups. And those who still focused on class were often rightfully seen as very orthodox leftists that weren't able to keep up with the social changes. That, of course, also required a formulation of new class politics. So somehow there was a gap in between those two currents within the left, where class as a serious political issue sort of disappeared.
Gabriel Kuhn is my guest. He's a writer and translator, editor of Anti-Fascism, Sports and Sobriety. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, one of the debates that has roiled the left in Europe, as it also has in the United States, has been around class versus culture. I wonder if you could talk about how that has played out in Europe and why you think that the ways the debate has been framed has been misguided.
I think related to the developments in the left that I mentioned before, I think one of the most really unfortunate developments was, and I can't really exactly say why that happened, but when in the, I would say 1990s here in Europe, maybe already in the 1980s, certain contradictions, social contradictions, and also contradictions within the left, were addressed more so than before. So contradictions along the lines of gender, race, nationality, and also new questions, the ecological question, entered the ranks of the left. Somehow, this was construed as something that was against the old class politics. So instead of adding this as an important component to class analysis that would make class analysis better, it was seen as something that would contradict class analysis. And I'm not blaming the people who introduced these new discussions. I don't know if there's anyone really to blame other than an unfortunate dynamic, but if there's anyone to blame, there would also certainly be those people to blame who held on to very orthodox beliefs of what class analysis should be about, and who saw all these new discussions with a certain skepticism. So you had these two camps that I described before, sort of very orthodox class-oriented left and new social movements, that instead of merging to actually in a kind of Marxist sense of forming a synthesis out of this that will make the left stronger, they ended up, those questions ended up more and more being framed in opposition to one another. And so today, I think this is similar in North America, although obviously I follow the discussions here in Europe more, but you have this apparent contradiction between class politics and what's often called identity politics. And I understand why people see that as a contradiction, given how a lot of these discussions have developed over the last 20 or 30 years. But if you look at the actual content of it, it's obviously no contradiction. I mean, the questions of gender, sexuality, race, etc., are as relevant for working class struggles as for any other struggles. So why exactly it was not able to combine these discussions to form a stronger left rather than to have a more divided left? I'm not sure. I'm afraid I have to say there was something lacking in the structure and the level of communication within the left itself.
Well, given the state of the left, which you've described as not particularly robust, how have people gone about trying to organize against right-wing politics, including when that right-wing politics manifests itself on the streets in violent form?
There are two different levels, but I start with this. In the 1980s, and then especially in the early 1990s, there was a really strong wave of nationalism again in Europe, very much so in Germany after German reunification. So around that time, anti-fascist struggle became really relevant again as an everyday reality of political organizing, while perhaps the decades before that, after World War II, a lot of it had to do with an analysis of how fascism and, in the German-speaking context, National Socialism could come about and what the ongoing legacy of it all were. But now you had new forms of fascist organizing, neo-Nazi organizations, and you had to meet and confront these forces. So on the radical end of the spectrum, you had anti-fascist groups, the so-called Antifa, which now, as I understand, has become a big phenomenon in the U.S. as well, organizing. And that included originally research and education, but also physical confrontation. There's been a certain response also by mainstream politicians, but it was delayed. I would say that the more radical left-wing anti-fascist movement definitely made anti-fascism a more general political agenda and was, in that sense, very effective in the late 1980s and then throughout the 1990s. Unfortunately, things have changed in the last 15, 20 years. Anti-fascist politics have been weakened, which also means that now, in this time of crisis, when the far right has become very strong again, which includes street violence. I mean, if we look at the example of Germany, for example, last year there were hundreds of attacks on homes of asylum seekers. And unlike in the early 1990s, where anti-fascists were able to quickly organize a strong response and the protection of, for example, homes for asylum seekers, this has not really been the case in the last few years, which I think is a reflection of the crisis of the left in general, but also a reflection of a certain crisis in anti-fascist organizing.
Well, let's talk a bit more about those days in the late 80s and the 1990s when the left was organizing more effectively around anti-fascism. So following the thread from the workers' militias in Austria in the 1920s up until the 90s and, of course, connecting it to now. What were the ways that they organized most effectively in that period?
I think the strength of the movement at the time really lay in the fact that the three components that I mentioned before, so this is research looking really into who are the people organizing in the far right, both individuals as well as groups, where does their money come from? Where do they meet? What are their forms of organization? How do they try to infiltrate mainstream media, for example? So this was one aspect, and then education was another aspect. So you'd go out with this information, you'd make it public, you write about and organize talks and conferences about what fascism means, both historically but also its current forms of organizing. And then the third component was the self-defense / confrontation part, where you would both protect places and events that were under threat of fascist attacks, but you would also seek out far-right demonstrations to counter-protest, etc. And so out of this, I think you were able to very effectively respond to, for example, the fascist attacks, or you were able, even better, to prevent them because you knew what they were about to do or what their what the focus of their activity was. And I think in the last 15 years, this strong unit of these three components has kind of broken apart and has left a sort of splintered anti-fascist movement that is no longer able to respond both that quickly and that effectively.
I think a lot of people, if they think about politics and sports in Europe, often the association is that of the far right and sports, soccer being one. Has there been, in recent decades, any connection between left-wing politics, including anti-fascist politics, and sports?
Oh, absolutely. Less so, although that exists too. There are anti-fascist, explicitly anti-fascist sports clubs that try to play sports in the tradition of the worker sports movement, explicitly or implicitly. But the stronger organizing, anti-fascist organizing, and in a lot of cases really explicitly anti-fascist organizing in sports, you see in supporters culture, mainly football supporters culture, because football is the most popular sport in Europe, attracts thousands of people to stadiums every weekend, and it has been and still is also one ground of recruitment for the far right. But there, for example, I often use that example. I would say that in the field of sports, and again, especially in Germany, the level of anti-fascist organizing has continued to be strong and has been very effective. So if you compare, for example, the influence of the far right in football stadiums in Germany in the 1990s to the influence today, it has dramatically weakened, although the far right in general now is very strong. So there are positive examples, and this is not only Germany for different reasons. It's a center of anti-fascist and left-wing organizing in the football supporters culture, but you have similar groups in most European countries.
In the United States, liberals and radicals have been pretty divided over the kinds of tactics that should be used to oppose the far right, whether to confront them frontally, whether to try and have their events canceled or appeal to the police. And there's been a lack of trust on all sides. Given all of that, what do you think is crucial for moving beyond the defensive moment-to-moment decisions around confronting the far right and finding a way to build a sustained anti-fascist politics?
My first answer would be very generally. What I'm really convinced of is that the best answer, especially long-term, to combat fascism is to establish a strong left. So this is one thing. Now, I understand that in terms of responding to immediate threats and dangers of the far right, that's not necessarily an answer, because to establish a strong left takes time. So let's look at these concrete situations. There is a far right protest, or the far right mobilizes, or there's a far right conference somewhere. So what do you do? I think it is very important to, A, point out, make it public that exists and what the kind of people are that organize and gather at those events. I think it is also important to try to stop these events from happening because of the symbolic impact, but also because it actually disrupts right-wing organizing, which is only a good thing. Now, how to do that, I really think, depends on, it sounds kind of like a cop-out, but I think that's the only sensible answer you can give. It very much depends on the circumstances. Plus, there are two aspects to it. There's the short-term aspect and there's the long-term aspect. So, for example, I'll take an example from Europe. So there is an event. Let's say there's a socialist book fair somewhere, and people from the far right come to attack this book fair. If people are there to then confront them and try to defend that book fair, and that ends up in a physical confrontation, it's something that sort of A, happens out of the circumstances, and B, is a necessity if you want to prevent a lot of people from getting hurt. So in a context like this, the answer is fairly simple. You need to achieve a short-term goal, which is defending this gathering of left-wing radical people, and you do whatever needs to be done. If, for example, it is a march by the far right, that doesn't necessarily imply immediate threat to people's lives or people's health, then it becomes more of a tactical question. I mean, there are lots of options. You could do a counter protest in a more modest, laid back kind of way. You could try to confront this march in a more physical way. And it's really hard to say. It depends on the given political situation at the time. It depends on public discourse. It depends on the allies you have. Unfortunately, I don't feel I can give any advice here from Europe on how to do this in specific situations. What I can add maybe is that if you then really go long-term, so you try to build a bridge from confronting the far right to building a strong left, then you can have more general discussions about how to do this and possibly build a movement where you agree upon certain tactics that are then applied in a more kind of broad and general sense. But then we're really going into anti-fascist leftist movement building, which I actually think is a very important thing, because even if you look at the history of the anti-fascist movement in Europe, even when it was most effective, it was mostly a defensive movement. So you try to avoid the far right from getting stronger, or you try to avoid or prevent them from destroying your own structures or hurting people. But it didn't really have a strong positive perspective as to what it really means to build an anti-fascist society. So that's an important component, I think, of any long-term anti-fascist movement.
I've been speaking with writer and translator Gabriel Kuhn. He's editor of Anti-Fascism, Sports and Sobriety, Forging a Militant Working Class Culture. And he's also a former professional soccer player. Gabriel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.